WMEX Quincy, Boston. Streaming at WMEXBoston.com. And on your smart speaker, just say play WMEX.
The greatest hits of all time are back. This is the all-new WMEX.
WMEX Boston.
They singing all night, drinking wine, spooty, ooty, drinking wine. Wine, spooty, ooty, drinking wine.
That's right, it's time for Wine by Design on 1510 with your friend Len Prasuti, presiding over all things wine. With over 30 years of experience in the corporate wine industry, Len is ready to be your personal wine connoisseur. Here every Friday at 6 p.m. on WMEX. Here's your host, Len Prasuti.
Well, thank you, Ben, and welcome everyone to Wine by Design. Just like to mention, if anyone has a question, feel free to call in to the radio station, WMEX, at 781-834-9639. That's 781-834-9639. You can also contact me via email if you have any other questions. I always get back to you, usually within a day or so. And that would be at lenwmex@gmail.com or lenwmex@gmail.com. You can also listen to every single past episode now, thank you, Ben, at wmexboston.com, or you can search Wine by Design on your favorite platform. Well, I made an announcement on Uncle Tony's Influential Italian Music Hour this afternoon that I'm going to be joining forces with Gennaro's Eatery in Quincy and helping them write a new wine list. They're at 12 Blanchard Road in Quincy. Great, great place to have the family go to eat, and also sponsor Uncle Tony's Influential Italian Music Hour. But I had a chance to meet with Jerry, and what a great guy. I'm really excited to work with him. I may have mentioned that I've had a chance to work with some really great chefs in the past, Ming Tsai, Lydia Shire, Barbara Lynch, Jacques Pepin. But I can honestly say I've never been more excited to work with a chef than working with Jerry. He's just so passionate, just about making his customers happy, about making great food, as well as providing one of the best possible dining experiences. It is an extremely reasonable price there. He has some really great new plans for the menu. And I believe we're going to be rolling out the wine list at the same time he rolls out his new menu, which is about a month or so from now. But in addition to the list, which is going to have some amazing values on it, some of the wines you're going to be able to buy there at the same price you'd pay for them at a package store, especially, surprisingly, some of the more expensive wines. But not only that, but we've talked and we're going to work together to come up with special pairings for all of his dishes. So it'll maybe even raise that dining experience a little bit even above where it is right now. There's no question that some of my favorite wines are going to be appearing on this list. There are tried and true favorites that we drink at the Prasuti household all the time that I've yet to find better examples of their type than them, or we'd be drinking them. But it is kind of interesting, the whole concept of coming up with the wine list and how the process goes and all that. And I thought I'd share with you a bit of what I go through. First of all, one of the really, really neat things about being into wine is there really is a wine community out there. I consider all of you listening to be part of that, quite frankly. But it's really kind of nice. You have friends out there that you share this common interest with and that you can bounce ideas off of and all that. I have a number of people that I call saying, yeah, I'm about to open 2012 Echo the Lynch Bosch. Now, how much air did you give that the last time you had it? And, how did that seem? Would you give it a little bit more, a little bit less, or all kinds of things like that? Well, actually, that's part of my work on the list. I've reached out to a number of my friends. Big hat tip to Jake, John, Jerry, Teresa, and Dex, as well as Tom of Lanesville Package Store in Gloucester, who's helping me to round up all these wines that we're looking at for the list so I can taste them and see if there's anything better and go through some comparisons and things like that. The first wine I decided to do research on, because for me, it's absolutely critical. In an Italian restaurant that especially has a lot of red sauce dishes on the list, is to come up with a great Barbera. Now, one that really kind of sings and accompanies those dishes beautifully. And that's not always easy. I went through this about 3 or 4 years ago just to try to find the best one out there at the time. And it wasn't easy. Barberas, mainly from the Piedmont region of Italy, but we're going to talk about one that's in a neighboring region too that was really, really great, are, in my opinion, the single best match, even better than Chianti in general, with tomato sauce-based dishes, because they have this beautifully crisp acidity along with this kind of juicy berry fruit for the best of them that provide the best match that just work tremendously well with the red sauce dishes. It's that whole thing that we've mentioned before of like acidity canceling acidity. So now the acidity in the tomato sauce is a little less. It seems like you've cooked it longer, it's richer, more complex, better, most people would say. And the acidity in the wine seems to go away, so the wine becomes much more velvety. But the problem exists in some of the style changes that have been going on with Barbera. And that's going back a number of years now, because traditionally, it was a wine that people drank pretty much on a daily basis in Piedmont. So it was that lower alcohol, comparatively, easy to drink, juicy style. Then people started to say to themselves, and I'm sure the whole wine spectator rating with numbers and all that that we talked about before came into play there. I'm going to try to make a bit more what they often refer to as a serious style, a little more meat on the bones there, a little bit more structured, a little more impressive, perhaps, in their minds, and giving it a maybe even some new oak aging and all that. But those types of wines don't work particularly well at the table. It is fascinating in that, as I mentioned, I did this about 3 or 4 years ago, and all of the wines, with one exception, were 14% alcohol and over. And almost none of them worked well with the food. But I got together a group of six Barberas here, based upon recommendations of friends and a few that I knew myself from a variety of places here. There's some little subsections of Piedmont that are known for making Barbera. So you can have just a generic kind of Barbera. Three of them fall into that category. Two were from Barbera d'Asti. Now, d'Asti is considered a very good little subsection there that makes very good wines that tend to be ready to drink a little earlier and tend to be a little bit more approachable. from the beginning. And then another one, of the group of six, was a Barbera d'Alba that many people consider to be the best area for Barbera. But again, sometimes when they say that, they're talking about the bigger kind of structured wines there. But as I mentioned, we had six of them. I'm just going to run through some of the names here. El Verde, Castelvero, Marco Pontarelli, San Quirico from Stefano Farina, the Truffle Hunter from Bosco. That's a pretty good marketing gimmick there, you know, Piedmont truffles, all that. And last but not least, the Battasiolo, which was the Barbera d'Alba out there, and did end up showing quite well. But anyway, we went through all of these and actually had a red sauce dish that we were trying against the wine just to make sure that we picked the one that we thought would be perfect with it. Now, I'm not going to go through all six wines describing absolutely everything about them, but I did want to comment on a few. They were all eminently drinkable. One was fading just a little bit. It was one that was under a natural cork. And I do think that there is something about having, especially the fresher style of Barbera, under a screw cap. Actually, three of the six were under screw cap because it maintains that freshness and that juiciness. However, in one case, that actually seemed to work against the wine. And that was with the Truffle Hunter, the Barbera d'Asti. It was very, very good wine, really good depth of flavor and concentration, but it just seemed young. It just seemed like it needed a little more time in bottle, you know, or maybe a little bit more aeration during the winemaking process or something like that. And I do believe that the fact that it was bottled in Stelvin, which keeps the wine younger and fresher, didn't allow that interaction with the oxygen to happen. So the wine seemed a little tight and young. So that's one we kind of eliminated there. One of the ones that I just loved because it brought me back to the way things used to be was the Marco Pontarelli Barbera. Old school all the way. It tastes the way the old school wines used to taste. There was this kind of earthy, kind of meaty quality there. And this is going to be difficult for me to explain in a way, but not that many years ago, there wasn't a super degree of cleanliness in the cellars and in the bottling lines and all that. And the wines, I guess it would be the opposite of antiseptic, where they just seem too clean and too pristine. The wines had what we often refer to as character and just had a lot more to offer in many ways. And if you want to try one of the old style wines, that's a great one to check out. Even the bottle, my God, it's gorgeous. It's the real old school Italian classical label. They even go as far as to have a wax stamp on these pieces of string that go up around the top of the bottle. Great, great presentation with the official paper seal that has to appear on them there. And just really great presentation and a lovely wine. It's just that it didn't have that vibrant, fresh, juicy quality that we were really looking for there. One other wine, honorable mention, the Battasiolo. Wow, that was very impressive. A really good wine. Great depth of flavor. Just a little bit too good. I know this sounds odd, but a little too good for the perfect match with the red sauce dishes. No question in my mind that it'd get at least a 90 in the Wine Spectator minimum. But again, we're not necessarily looking for what would be rated the highest. We're looking for the wine that's going to go best with the food. And that brings us to the winner, which was the Alverde. And that wine, I'm looking at the label right now, gorgeous label, all kinds of flowers over it. It is a Stelvin closure, as I mentioned, but in this case, it really maintains the juicy freshness of the wine. It isn't from the Piedmont region. It's from Lombardy, right next door. And that is possibly why they're able to produce such an amazing wine at such an amazing price. The other thing I should mention, and this is prominently displayed on the label, is that it is even made with organically grown grapes. So no pesticides of any sort or anything like that in the vineyards, which keeps the wine fresh and clean. But the wine in the bottle, my God, we hit the mother lode, so to speak, looking for the perfect Barbera to match with food. It had this really nice, incredibly juicy, that's what we're looking for here, is juicy, kind of black cherry, raspberry, kind of darker flavors, not that bright cherry that you sometimes get. But it was just made so much more fun and interesting by this black pepper spiciness that it had. And again, it just sang with the red sauce. So that is the wine that we are going to pour by the glass on the Gennaro's list. I did also want to mention that there does seem to be a stylistic change happening in Barbera, again, back to that lighter style. As I mentioned before, not that many years ago, 3 or 4, when I did the same kind of exercise, everything was 14% alcohol and above. Here, every wine was under 14%. The highest percentage of alcohol was 13.5%, and the Alverde, the one that we chose, was 12.5%. And those are the wines very often that we love having with the food. And it just, when you get it right, boy, it's just so much fun because they both elevate each other. And the best part that I was saving for last year is I actually bought this off the shelf at my wine store here, Waynesville Package, just a couple miles from where I live, for under $10 a bottle. Now, not much. It was $9.99. But still, wow, what a value. Anyway, I'm going to be sharing with you some explorations for other wines that we're doing here for the list. And I'm really looking forward to it. We were talking about perhaps having a really big rollout when this is finished. And as I did mention before, he has a brand new menu in the works here. And I think we're going to reveal or celebrate, so to speak, the wine list along with that new menu. And hopefully the details haven't been set yet, but we'll get together with Jerry and make it a big party where maybe there can kind of be a wine tasting in addition to sampling his menu. Well, now on to a listener question. I got a great question from James from Haverhill. He just said simply, what is phylloxera? And I've talked about it in the past. And it seems like it's this boogeyman of the grape varieties. And it really did wreak devastation on the grapevines. One of the names for it that's most commonly used is Phylloxera vestatrix, which means the devastator. It is actually a small little bug. It's very, very tiny. I actually had a chance to hold it in my hand at a nursery vineyard in Germany. And it's insidious in that this little bug, they travel in colonies, has something in its saliva so that when it bites into the root of the vine, it won't heal. And the sap just seems to leach out, weakening the vine. Now, they're so small that it takes a lot of them to really hurt a grapevine, and it actually takes place over a number of years. You know, sometimes if it's fast acting, 3 or 4, sometimes it can go on for more than 10 before it totally devastates the vine. And kind of the interesting thing there is, in the beginning of the phylloxera infestation of the vine, it actually produces better wine for the first couple years, because it limits the yields to the point where the vine has the energy that it has left to throw into fewer bunches of grapes, and those grapes have more flavor to them. But just a little bit more about where it came from and how it attacked the vineyards primarily of Europe. The phylloxera louse is native to the United States, mainly eastern United States there. And the vines, not of of the European varieties, but of the American varieties, have an immunity to it because they kind of grew up in the same area. But it wasn't too long before we had interaction here between Europe and the United States that they started taking a look at some of our grapevines out there. And a lot of them were sent over in pretty big quantities to a lot of the vineyards in France, to the point where they wanted to experiment with them. But this little phylloxera louse found its way onto those vines and got transferred into the vineyards. It was first discovered, I believe, in 1863, if memory serves me correctly, in England, and found its way to the south of France in the Rhone Valley around that same time. But eventually it became widespread and just totally devastated the vineyards of Bordeaux. In the beginning, they didn't really know what it was. And they just realized that, you know, my God, we're losing all of our vines here. It's kind of like the equivalent of nuclear disaster in the vineyards. And French wine production took a nosedive. It went from about 85 million hectoliters in 1875 to a little over 20 million in 1889. Really horrible. They did realize fairly early on that something devastating was happening, and they did their best to identify it. In 1873, the government, thinking, well, we got to get people working on this and dedicating their time and efforts to finding a cure, offered a 300,000 franc, which is millions of dollars in today's currency, as a reward for anyone that could come up with a remedy for this phylloxera. And almost 700 different methods of dealing with it were submitted. You know, many of them just really pretty ridiculous, but they entertained all of them. Nothing really seemed to work. But two schools of thought kind of developed here. They were either going to use chemicals, which, oh my God, you know, there's enough problems with chemicals in the vineyards already, or the whole thing of, since the American vines didn't seem to be affected by it because they had an immunity, to use American rootstock and graft things over to it. Turns out that wasn't as easy said as done, because a lot of the rootstocks, the American rootstocks that they experimented with in the beginning, didn't really work with the different types of calcareous soils in that they had in Europe, which varied pretty dramatically from most of them in the United States. But a Texan, T.V. Munson, who was a nurseryman, worked with vines and all that, actually figured out which American rootstock worked best with the European varieties in the European soils in 1878. So then came this enormous task of trying to graft all the vines over. It wasn't easy. It took forever. They had to get the rootstock, get it over there, you know, regraft the vines and all that. Some of the grapes did not take well to it. When we talked about Bordeaux, that's one of the reasons why they stopped using Malbec pretty much, is the fact that when they tried to, it was one of the most popular grapes of Bordeaux before they had to graft it, and they couldn't control yields or anything like that. It was just a true nightmare. But when they started getting the vineyards back up and operating, they realized that they had a cure here, and they spread the word throughout so that everyone could take advantage of it. One of the things that did happen before it was widely known that, okay, we have this under control, it's still going to be a major problem, but, you know, we can recover from this. There was that point where they didn't think that there was a cure and that one would ever be found. And some of the people from some of the major wine regions of France, for instance, where it seemed to take hold first, actually tried traveling elsewhere to make wine because they were, you know, saying, wow, this is over. Bordeaux's over. The people from Bordeaux tended to go to Rioja, working with the Tempranillo grape, which was actually really great for the development of the Rioja wines because they brought their expertise and showed them what they were doing in Bordeaux to make some of the greatest red wines in the world. So the quality of Rioja went up pretty dramatically. The same thing kind of happened with the people in Champagne, only they gravitated to the Cava region in the Penedès. And it happened right around when Cava was starting, and Cava adopted the method Champenois, the way of making wines sparkle with that secondary fermentation in the bottle. And that worked out really well from them. They kept their own identity in using the name Cava and using, especially in the beginning, native grapes like Macabeo and a lot of the others. But the upshot of that is a lot of the wine regions actually benefited from the spread of phylloxera and the spread of the winemaking information that came from people traveling to different areas. The only other thing I did want to mention is, you know, all the vinifera grapes in California too are on these American rootstocks, but some were more phylloxera resistant than others. And in California, one of the vines that they used, this AXR1, turned out to be susceptible to this mutation of phylloxera that did happen there. Now, the reason we pretty much know it was that rootstock that caused it was 70% of the grapes in Napa and Sonoma were planted to it, and 70% of their vines died. Cost about well over $1 billion in damage, and was just devastating. I saw it move through the vineyards of Spotswood, and you could see the vines dying. Just, oh my God, it was heartbreaking. Spotswood, one of the best Cabernet producers in the United States. But anyway, it's under control, even though it is pretty worldwide here. And the fact is that some of the places kind of escaped. We talked about Argentina and their parts of Australia with quarantines and that it hasn't reached yet. Well, that's about it for this week. Just wanted to remind you that you've been listening to Wine by Design with Len on 1510. If you like the show, please tell your wine-loving friends about it. We'd love to share. Thanks for listening. Until next week, all the best in wine and life.